In other words, you wouldn't automatically raise the value of the property because somebody did the right job.
Members? I'm going to call this meeting to order. We do not have a quorum yet, but we are going to get started, and I'll note the quorum later on. I am pleased today that we're going to be televised, and just wanted you all to note that. With that, we will ask Michael Madonna from the Legislative Commission on you know what I'm doing. You say it.
Morning,
I always do it by its initials now, and I miss the words.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Commission members. I'm Michael McDonough from the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. I'm here to introduce the team that's going to do the statewide conservation plan. Just a little bit of background. The legislation last year, as part of the reform of the LCMR, called for the provided funding for the LCCMR to do a RFP, request for proposal, to do a statewide conservation and preservation plan. We advertised nationally and listed the RFP in the state register. We had quite a bit of response. We ended up having three teams that were put together and presented to the LCCMR. We set up a selection committee, and the selection committee, as well as the full LCCMR, unanimously selected the team led by the university's new Institute on the Environment to do the statewide conservation plan. And I want to introduce Deb Swackhammer, who's the interim director of the Institute on the Environment, and Gene Coleman from Sierra Planning, who are going to do a presentation in about a half hour to talk about the statewide plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Swackhammer? Ms. Coleman? Welcome to the committee. We're glad you're here.
Thank you, and good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Deborah Swackhammer. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota, and I am currently the interim director of the new Institute on the Environment at the university, and I also serve as the principal investigator of the grant that we're going to talk to you about today, the contract with LCCMR to prepare a statewide conservation and preservation plan for the state of Minnesota. With me is Gene Coleman, who will be serving as the project coordinator for the LCCMR contract, and she is also a principal with CR Planning. At your request, I have been asked to give a brief overview of the Institute on the Environment. I'm happy to share a few thoughts on the Institute with you, and then we will proceed to give you a briefing of our plans for the LCCMR project. So the University of Minnesota has embarked on an interesting strategy as part of its strategic positioning, and that's to create an institute on the environment. This has the full backing and support of the administration at the university, and the creation of the institute on the environment is one of the key strategic initiatives being conducted by the university to position the university as one of the top research universities in the world. The Institute on the Environment will be a world-class research institute. We are creating a competitive center of excellence that will focus on global environmental issues that have regional significance, and we will be conducting problem-driven research to produce solutions. So it is not an ivory tower, monolithic sort of put a bunch of professors off in a tower and let them think great thoughts. This really is a problem-driven institution within the university, and we will, as you can see from the second bullet here, engagement of stakeholders is a key component, a key principle of this new institute. It will do more than research. It will connect that research to stakeholders at all parts of the process. Stakeholders will be engaged to help define the research problems, to help define those research approaches, as well as to help implement those solutions. In addition, at the university, we have such a broad range of environmental expertise and activities going on around the environment. What this institute will do is bring them together under one umbrella. And so we will be creating a community of environmental scholars and help facilitate and coordinate all things environmental at the university as one of the functions of this institute. And to sum it all, really, it is that the institute will make it so that environmental activities, their whole, will be greater than the sum of their parts. Currently, they're quite diffuse and spread out, and now they will be under one roof. So when you, as legislators, wish to find out what's going on with anything to do with the environment at the university, you will be able to access that information through one portal through the Institute on the Environment. It really is a new way of doing things at the university. We will be team-based. We will take a systems approach to approaching environmental problems. We will be making that linkage between research, policy, implementation, and public engagement. It'll be cross-disciplinary. It's not just environmental science. It is truly environmental everything. So we're integrating basic sciences with agricultural science, with the professional schools in the health, the Academic Health Center, with economics, with policy, and with humanities. We've just named the first 15 founding fellows of the Institute, and they come from 15 different colleges at the university. So this is not just a few, it's not just interdisciplinary, it's very cross or transdisciplinary. And ultimately, we want to have measurable, high-impact results. I think I'll just, in the interest of time, go right to an example of how the Institute really can benefit not just the university in terms of bringing together its environmental programs, but also an example of how we can work much better with the state, with our state stakeholders, and in particular, in today, talking about how we can work better with the state legislature. So let me now proceed talking about the LCCMR, Minnesota Statewide Conservation and Preservation Plan. This is a public-private partnership involving the University of Minnesota as the lead on this particular effort, but it is in partnership with two private consulting firms, CR Planning and Bonestro, which has recently combined with ESU. The goal, of course, is a common goal to all of us, and that is to create a better future for Minnesota's resources. This goal is not a small goal. It is a very large goal, but we're happy to take on this task, and we're quite excited at taking on this task and working with you and with the other state stakeholders to do a good job at this. Our vision is will take place. We'll be implementing this vision over the next 18 months, and it's to create a common understanding of the current state of Minnesota's resources. It's to create useful tools for both the short-term and long-term decisions by LCCMR. It's to create, essentially, an environmental strategic plan. This statewide conservation and preservation plan will both inform LCCMR, as well as other partners such as the EQB, and other state agencies that have the responsibility for managing Minnesota's resources. The recommendations will cover all of the natural resources across the state: air, land, water, fish, wildlife, and the other category, which we are interpreting as meaning recreation. And we will make recommendations on how to achieve a better future for all of these resources in an integrated fashion. The organization of our project will include project coordinators. For the project coordinators were essentially our Gene, who I've already introduced, as well as working with LCCMR staff, and the principal there is Michael McDonough. We have a core management team, which consists of the members of all the various players, the University of Minnesota, and the consulting firms that I mentioned. And this core management team is really the decision-making body that will interact with the large cast of players, which I'm about to talk about, and also interface with the project coordinator. The research and analysis teams is where the many, many players come into play. We will have team members that populate the various teams focused on these natural resource areas of air, water, land, fish, wildlife, and other, as well as partners. And these partners are members of these teams that were from outside of the university or of these consulting firms. And so, in other words, these partners would include state agency staff, county, NGO, et cetera, all kinds of different stakeholder people that can help with fulfilling this the overall mission of this project. The partners will help identify the issues. They'll help identify data sources. They will help consider what future we want and the future we won't get if we, I mean, the future we will get if we don't make changes, or the future we'll get if we do make changes. So this is the overall organization. You have a handout that actually has a much more detailed picture that doesn't do so well as a slide, but you have the detail in front of you on the back or front of one of the handouts that you have. that is a more detailed version of this. Now let me talk a little bit about our approach and the products that will come from it. This project will produce a preliminary as well as a final plan that will be comprised of useful tools and recommendations to achieve this desired future for natural resources in the state. There is two phases to achieving our project goals. This approach is also on the other side of the handout that I just referred to. So it's on the reverse side of the project organization handout. So again, the detail is hard to see on the slide, but you have the detail in front of you as well. This diagram is really meant to display our overall project approach and illustrate the major products. First, there will be a preliminary plan. This will be produced quite quickly in the next 6 months, actually 5.5 months now, by the end of June 2007. And the final plan will be produced by June 2008. The next couple of slides will get into more detail on this. So let me first talk about the preliminary plan. The preliminary plan will start with a snapshot of pre-settlement conditions using existing data that are available to us. So the preliminary plan will provide understanding of both the current and emerging issues, and it will help provide recommendations to inform short-term LCCMR funding priorities. We will synthesize the existing data to develop a preliminary understanding of the current condition of the state's resources. We will present this information in GIS maps and text. We will identify key issues for each natural resource category that will essentially and also identify the drivers of change within that are creating those key issues. And as I just mentioned, we will provide for you recommendations that will be developed to inform short-term funding priorities for the LCCMR and to set the stage for our final plan. We will also identify information gaps, and we will make recommendations for additional research needs. The final plan is really going to be the meat of this study. What we are proposing to do for the final plan is to provide descriptions of two possible futures for the state around chosen key issues. The first would be the future of the state's resources if we maintain current policies and actions. The second scenario will be the preferred future, if we implement a recommended set of resource conservation and preservation strategies. Okay, so let me be very clear about that. The first scenario is the trajectory, business as usual. The second scenario will be the trajectory if we make and follow a certain set of key recommendations for how to manage our resources. And presumably this would be the preferred strategy for the state to follow. But that, of course, we will be developing those strategies. These scenarios will be created with GIS-based simple forecasting. They're not an academic exercise in modeling. These are a means for deciding on practical implementation strategies to achieve the preferred future. The final conservation and preservation plan will include recommended strategies for achieving the preferred future and recommended strategies for each natural resource category and for linking across those categories. It's very important that to create these scenarios and strategies that we engage the public, and we're absolutely committed to this aspect of the project. So we emphasize engaging the public. Our public engagement goals are twofold. The first is to engage people to gather local knowledge to inform the process and products, and secondly, to build support for the final plan and their selected strategies. We have put together a statewide communication strategy. We are committed to comprehensive statewide outreach. The primary tool will be partnering, and the primary strategy will be leveraging with an existing program already underway at the University of Minnesota, and that will be to leverage with what's called the Minnesota 2050 Project Scenario Building Workshops. These are being funded by the Bush Foundation already to the Bush Sustainability Initiative at the University of Minnesota. And I want to point out that, in fact, this leveraging is bringing an additional approximately $270,000 of leveraging money to bring to bear to match the LCCMR funds from the legislature. These scenario building workshops will bring together a broad range of people to and they will be asked to create plausible scenarios for what Minnesota resources will look like in 2050. These scenarios will help inform the final statewide plan. In addition, we will use networks such as the Association of Minnesota Counties, the League of Minnesota Cities, Builders Association, etc., to invite comments and participation in the by the broadest range of citizens. Stakeholder groups will be engaged in the process through targeted outreach. So we have multiple layers of engagement going from these sort of larger categories down into regional and then local areas of involvement. Let me finish by saying we are excited about working with you together on the future of the state's natural resources strategies. And that, to sum up, that we are pleased to have created this public-private partnership to help plan and act effectively for the long-term conservation and preservation of the state's resources. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions or ask questions to Jean when I can't do so.
Members? Yes, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm interested in the relationship to human health, I guess, and I don't see health issues connected on here. And I did hear you say that the Academic Health Center is one of your stakeholders, I believe. And I don't see that anywhere on the chart here. It seems like the closest we come to it is toxins under air. But it seems to me like the conservation of our natural resources is for the enjoyment of human beings, and one of our major concerns, at least one of my major concerns right now, is environmental health. Our committee recently looked at the issue of water contamination. So if we were to ask this incredible new resource that's being created here to help address that issue, where would we go? And is that something you're planning to take on? And maybe it's just not reflected in the data before us, but I'm very interested in your take on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, actually the chart that you see was in the proposal, and we had just pulled together the partners that were identified at the time were those that we had specifically spoken to and had commitments from. We didn't want to list partners that we hadn't actually worked out arrangements with. But let me assure you that public health is very much front and center. As an example, myself, my academic appointment at the university is in the Division of Environmental Health Sciences in the School of Public Health, and I'm involved in the water team. And we have now spoken to members of the Minnesota Department of Health, and we have assurances that we will have participation from members from the Department of Health. In addition, the chair of the AIR Committee, the two co-chairs of the AIR Committee are also from the Division of Environmental Health Sciences within the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota. And so their focus is very much from a perspective of air quality, primarily affecting human health as well as ecological health. So peppered throughout these committees, we have participation by health professionals, and we have every intention of partnering with the Department of Health and with the county and other local units that deal with public health issues. So I'm sorry that's not better reflected, and we will be updating this as we this chart as we actually get these partners on board. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I just say that the committee that I chair here is the Health and Housing Committee, and we are looking at some of those issues. So I'd be very interested in working with you, and maybe we'll have you come before our committee too.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Mo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a very intriguing project. Excuse me. Obviously, this is the Environment Natural Resource Finance Committee, and we're often concerned about dollars and cents. And I know you have a sundry faculty that are involved in this project. I'm assuming they all still maintain teaching loads. This obviously is going to cost some money. Potentially, ideally in the future, obviously it's going to save us a lot of money, to collaborate. I mean, that's extremely important. But do you have any financial projections? What is this going to cost? Who are the partners that you're looking to raise money from?
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, let me first address the issue of the current funding, of course, has already been established. The contract was for $300,000, and we have put together a project that we feel can be done within that budget. So we put together what we think it will take $300,000 to do. That being said, it is heavily leveraged with university resources that don't show up as dollar signs. So, for instance, the university faculty that are involved in this, and I should mention that more than 40 university faculty from 12 different departments and 8 different colleges are involved in this project. It's a huge cast of characters. None of those faculty are receiving any money compensation directly. We are leveraging their existing salaries, and essentially it's service to the state. We feel it's very important that the university partner with the state as part of its land grant mission to do this work. And so we're able to leverage tremendous university resources because we are already a public institution that should be working on these kinds of issues. We have also crafted Gene has done a remarkable job of crafting how these folks will interact. We're not going to be asking for tons of their time. We're being very strategic in how we use the faculty time because we know it's very precious, and they do have other things to do. So we are making sure that the number of meetings they attend and how they interact with the entire group is very well laid out and is respectful and conservative of their time. So we're mostly taking advantage of their intellectual resources, and we are hiring staff, students and the like, to do some of the actual, you know, sort of day-to-day, the grunt work, if you will, putting together the databases, et cetera. So that's how we're kind of doing that. In terms of leveraging, we're also leveraging this existing Bush grant. As I mentioned, to the tune of about $270,000, we're working. The mission of that grant was so coincided so nicely with some of the goals of this particular contract that we were able to mesh those and leverage them, and the principals in that project are part of the, in fact, part of the leadership team of this contract. Gina is anxious to say something, so I'll stop there and let her respond as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, to the second part of your question, which I believe spoke to how do we evaluate costs associated with recommendations or strategies. And we, I think, uniquely have built into our project a cost-benefit analysis, a qualitative cost-benefit analysis component requested by the LCCMR in their request for proposals to evaluate alternative strategies. In that second phase, when we develop that preferred scenario, there will be a selection of alternative strategies that could be undertaken to achieve the preferred scenario. We will apply a qualitative cost-benefit analysis to those strategies to recommend the relative benefit to the cost of each of those strategies.
Thank you. Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about where, I mean, this is part of the university, and there's 15 different colleges and departments and all of these things working on these issues. How is the physical part of it going to be set up? I mean, will there be an institute on the environment where people come? I mean, I've recently been in a university broad environment-based program, and it's a lot smaller than the University of Minnesota, and I'm just wondering how you're actually bringing these people together.
Madam Chair, Representative Knuth, that's a great question. I feel like I get to kind of say all over again how neat it is that the university is developing this institute in the environment. Frankly, if the institute hadn't already been conceived and already sort of launched, I'm not sure that the university could have gotten it all together to pull all these people together from 8 different colleges and all those different departments. Because it takes a lot of coordination to do that. And the institute is serving in that exact function. That is the purpose of creating this institute, is to help facilitate these very large, complicated groups of people. The institute will have physical space. At the moment, it's being decided where that's going to be, but we will have physical space. It's not a virtual institute where it's, you know, sort of like an email institute. This will have physical space. The faculty that are fellows within the Institute will have joint appointments and will have office space within the Institute. It will have a full staff. It's still being formulated, but it is a physical presence that will touch every college and every campus, all the coordinate campuses as well, within the university system.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to either of you. I'm wondering a couple things. The Institute for Renewable Energy and the Environment is currently coming to the end of their 5 years of money, and it's, I think, in my opinion, proven successful to we know where it is on campus, and we know who's running it. So, I mean, what is it going to be, that type of model? And the second part is, in the nation, I'm wondering if there's other national universities of the scale of the University of Minnesota that are proposing or have proposed the same type of institute, how much money they raised publicly, how much they raised privately, where it is in the priority of some of the other universities in the nation that I assume are doing some of the same type of work.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, in terms of finding the Institute of the Environment, yes, as soon as we have physical space, we will be a very prominent, we'll have quite a prominent presence at the university. And I should also let you know that that IRE, the Initiative on Renewable Energy and Environment, is under the Institute. And its function and structure won't be changing. You still find Dick Hemmingson when you need to, and he'll still have a physical office, but it will be under the Institute, which will also have a physical presence. And again, I want to emphasize that I think just like with renewable energy, where you do have a place to go, the Institute on the Environment will provide that for all environmental issues, for public health issues, for anything that is of concern with the environment. The Institute will be the portal to the university and take this kind of black box that no one can kind of negotiate very well, and you'll have a means of actually accessing the university. So we believe that this will enhance all the environmental efforts, including the efforts on renewable energy. To speak to your second question, yes, there are many universities across the country that have realize that environmental issues are front and center in this century, and that we need to be addressing them using an interdisciplinary approach. I want to say that there is there's probably, we could probably find between 20 and 50 such institutions at other universities around the country. We feel that we are positioned to create one of the most competitive ones in the nation, if not the world. And the reason is because of the breadth of the University of Minnesota, having both a land-grant mission, having all the professional schools, having a law school, having the depth and breadth within humanities and technology and sciences that we have, that we can create an institute on the environment that truly can address everything from policy to law to the science to the implementation of environmental problems. All of the other well-known and established environmental institutes that are at universities focus on one part of that. Some are very policy-oriented, some are just science-oriented, some are just law-oriented. And we feel that where our niche is going to be is that we can actually cover all of those bases and integrate across all those disciplines.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and for the testifiers. I have a question about the final plan, the statewide conservation and preservation plan, and it talks about mapping priority natural resource areas. And my question is, how specific are you going to get? Are you going to provide details of things that we actually can take action on, or the LCCMR can take action on in the future? And my reason for asking that is that at a local level in Dakota County, we had a similar plan prepared through a process funded through the old LCMR, and it identified through citizen involvement very specific areas that could be protected. And then the county and the citizens decided to follow up on that and provide a plan to protect those. Is this looking at doing a similar thing? Is it going to be specific enough, or is it just going to say protect generally these areas? Is it going to be detailed where we can take action for the future?
if I could, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. I was involved in the implementation phase of that Dakota County project. I developed the manual for implementing it, and I do believe that we will reach that type of specificity for the state, but realize that it is a state-level plan and not a county-level or local plan. We will produce maps that identify the location of resources that are determined to be priority resources. And so, for example, land cover, which is a very rich data set in Minnesota, will inform our choices for priorities to determine how to protect those priority areas. In addition, I want to emphasize that we will be collaborating with ongoing efforts that are of a similar type. Particularly, the Campaign for Conservation has done a great job in identifying some of those resources statewide. We will be collaborating with them on their information and perhaps using that and taking it a step or two further. And similar for water and the other resources, I would assume we would take it.
I don't see any other questions, so I'd like to thank you very much for coming, and thank you even more for what you're doing for the state of Minnesota.
It's our pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for coming. And while Representative Tingelsted is getting ready to do a bill presentation, I'd like to tell members to look on their email for an invitation to a presentation next Tuesday by faculty at the University of Minnesota at 4 o'clock in the afternoon in the House chambers. That's during Representative Eakin's time, and there will be three presenters, one, or is it four? I'm going to miss this. Dr. David Tillman, and I think you all are aware of his work, but many of you have not heard from him directly. There will be Dr. Frelick, who will talk about forestry, and Dr. Lucinda Johnson, who will talk about habitat. And all this is in the context of global warming. So it is going to be introduced by Will Steger. It should be an exciting presentation. It will be on the House floor because it's a joint meeting between four committees of the House and three of the Senate, and that's the big. That was the only location that was big enough. We would like to know if you can't attend, because we will put your nameplate above on one of the desks there so that everybody has a spot, because we think that other people who are not on our committees are going to want to come, and I want to make sure there are reserved spots for every one of you. But if you're not going to come, please let us know. This will be televised and taped for cable, so that I don't want somebody's nameplate up there and they are missing. So please let us know. You can let either the committee administrator or let the committee administrator know. Did you have something to say on that, Representative? Okay. So I know for the record that we have had a quorum, and Representative Scalzi, would you move the minutes of the 23rd?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The minutes have been moved for January 23rd. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Minutes have been approved. We're now going to hear from...
We're going to have their presentation first. Continuation.
Oh, I didn't know we were going to have additional. Are we going to have additional presentation or not? I'm sorry. Oh, yes, we do have some continuation, and I apologize for that. Okay. We're going to try to watch our time. Maybe I'm just getting jumped ahead because I'm watching my time.
Madam Chair, my name is John Valina. I'm the director for the LCCMR. It's your pleasure. I know the bill author is anxious to get to the bill, and I think maybe members Well, let me put it this way. If you want to hear more about what's in the biennial report, we're happy to do that, either now or in person. We send an email out to all members inviting you to contact us, and we'll come and meet with you virtually or in person, and at your pleasure. In the interest of time, if there aren't any pressing questions on the biennial report, and I actually think because Representative Tinglestead has done such a marvelous job as one of the three co-chairs of the commission, that she could probably handle any of those questions quite well anyway. So I'm at your pleasure.
Are there questions of Mr. Boleyn at this point? Then let us start. And I think sometimes when you are presenting an actual product, the questions that might come out about the biennial report would naturally flow. So if you could help out there. And while Representative Tinglestead is getting set up, I just want members to know that she has chaired the commission through, I think, an extraordinarily difficult time and done a super job at it, keeping on track the presentation now in January of something that a lot of folks thought couldn't get done to be presented by the legislature. So I am grateful for the work she has done. I think the commission is grateful for the work she's done, and welcome her to present the first bill of this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for those kind words. For the record, I'm Representative Kathy Tinglestead, and I'd like to move that House File 293 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. As Chair Wagenius stated, this is a work product of the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, as we've been hearing about from the previous presentation by Mr. Boleyn and his staff of the LCCMR. And I'd like to make note, too, that there are several people here today who have been very involved in putting together this product. In the audience is Nancy Gibson, who is a citizen member of the group, and former Representative Pete Nelson, who also served on the LCCMR. Representative Osmond and Chair Wagenius also served this fall as we were putting together this package, so I'd like to thank them, and I'm sure they'd be available for any questions that members may have. I know you have a lot of materials in front of you that relate to this package. Basically, what I'd like to highlight is that it's a $23 million package with the LCCMR, and there are no general fund dollars in this. It comes from the bulk of it comes from the proceeds of the lottery, and I know that you had received a handout on that the other day, and there may be additional questions that relate to that. But let me just kind of overview what's in your packet. Besides the bill, House File 293, there should be some things clipped together, a green sheet that I'll be working off of, a white sheet that shows the delineation of the projects that are within this $23 million package. Also, another white sheet, which is actually a copy from our budget book. I know some of the freshmen especially didn't know what those three books were that were delivered to each of our offices, and that, of course, is the governor's whole state budget. One of the pages within those three books is this Minnesota Resources Legislative Citizen Commission, and outlines what's here in the package, and goes right in line with what we'll be presenting today. Also, a yellow sheet that shows the proposals received, and we always receive many more proposals than we can fund. And then the last page, the salmon page, is the list of recommendations. So what we actually did fund from the number of projects that were received. And as Chair Wagenius outlined, this was the first process that we went through with the newly formed LCCMR. And so we had a condensed schedule this fall. We normally would have a year to do the whole process that we did in about 4 months. So we learned a few things along the way, and we did things maybe a little differently this first time than what we'll do it the second time around. But I just really want to make note of the
great involvement of the citizens on this commission. As you recall, it's seven of the 17 members are citizens. And they went through a competitive selection process through the governor's office. Five of them were appointed directly through the governor's office, one from the House, one from the Senate. And this was the first time they were right at the table making decisions with us. And I felt like they really added a lot to the process. They had great questions, people who are in the field every day, and really added a lot to how we put together this package. And so with that, I'd like to just do some highlights from the green sheet. I'll walk through the bill. I know Chair Wagenius has an amendment, and then open for questions, and hopefully we can move the bill to taxes today. Okay, with the green sheet, I've covered some of this, but the commission is recommending 29 projects to the legislature through the trust fund appropriations, and anybody who hasn't been through this process before, it moves through this committee as legislation, whatever other committees, it will go through finance, ways and means, to the floor. And actually, we had a task force group that worked on reorganizing the LCCMR into the LCMR, wait, one C to two Cs, LCMR to LCCMR. And they recommended that this bill travel separately and actually be passed early in the session, if possible, so that we can have the entire summer season this year to look at projects. The funding is not available until July 1st, but if the project partners know in April and May that their project has been signed by the governor, there are certain things that they can do to get the project going faster, so they're ready to go at the time the funding is available. So there's two major themes of this bill in front of you here, land protection, about 22,000 acres, and water quality and quantity and air protection. And basically the summary of the $23 million package is outlined before you there in the green sheet. Land acquisition, about $12 million. Land restoration, $2.5 million. Natural resources inventory and analysis, $4.1 million. Natural resource research, $2.9 million.
We will take questions as we go. It's okay. Just easier. And Representative Magnus has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question of Representative Tingelstad, and maybe Mr. Velland can help out with this too. But is the 23,366 is that the interest off of the fund, or and can you tell me what the balance of the fund is now? I saw in your documents the other day it was I think $377 million in '05, but can you tell us roughly what that is now?
Madam Chair, John Vallien, yes, the fund balance, the corpus of the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, is about $415 million. The legislature is authorized to appropriate up to 5.5% of whatever that balance is on June 30th of each even-numbered year. So 5.5% per year of the 415 gets you to the 23,366 number. And there will be an equal amount available for fiscal 8. And hopefully we'll be back this time next year.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair, so I can assume then that the $413 million up from $377 million into corpus of the trust is going.
It's doing very nicely.
And historically going. All right. Thank you.
But it, Madam Chair, it is subject to market, especially stock market activities. It's an aggressive portfolio of about 70% growth stocks. Because the corpus is inviolate and it's perpetual, the managers can take a very, very aggressive long-term approach, and that's what they're doing with the 70% of the portfolio is in long-term growth stocks. The remaining 30% is in high-quality bonds. When in days past, when we were operating off the interest earnings on the trust fund only, and this is that's a difference, the portfolio was more like 50-50 because the legislature wanted more current income. Now that has changed as of the 1998 constitutional amendment change. so that it's 5.5% of the corpus. So it operates very much more like a traditional standard endowment fund from in the private sector. Yeah.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Velen, is that fund administered by the State Board of Investment, or who?
The State Board of Investment, yes.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara has a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Director Velen, I'm going to have a follow-up to some of the good questions that Representative Magnus asked. A couple of things. I think it's interesting that when we see on TV, we always see him talk about promoting the lottery and the loon or whatever we're doing. But I think we should actually probably be showing a textbook and a road and everything else, because isn't the reality, as I look here, and I'm going to have kind of a twofold question. I thought the trust fund was supposed to get at least 40%. I think the vast majority of our constituents think all the proceeds go to the loon and the environment, which where they should be, by the way, and I think that we're going to move, at least some of us are going to want that to move in that direction. What, as we talk about having $400 million, isn't the reality that we'd have over $1 billion today if we'd have put all that money that the folks think goes into the trust fund, into the trust fund? That's one question, and maybe you can ask the other one would be, it looks to me like we only get about a third of the money when it's really supposed to be 40%. I would imagine you got some administrative costs or something that we're getting hooked on, but it looks like the general fund is getting twice as much as the Environmental Trust Fund gets.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, you are correct. In the first question, the lottery has brought into the state of Minnesota well over $1 billion since it started. The distinction, however, comes at determining the net proceeds. It's not the gross proceeds. It's not the total of sales. It's the net proceeds. And as you saw on this chart the other day, this big dark blue area over here is prizes that go back to the players. This is a recreational game for the most part. Some people maintain that it's an investment by individuals that ought to be returned to them. I happen to differ with that, and I say it's a recreational game. And so there's an in lieu of sales tax that comes off. That slices up in those parts that go to the Game and Fish Fund and the Natural Resources Fund, the in lieu money. And then the 40% of the net proceeds goes to the trust fund. There is potential for argument, again, in determining net proceeds. One could take a very simple, clear view, and that is that anything that's not paid out in prizes or actual administrative costs that are necessary to run the program is net proceeds. In the simplest view of the world, it's either profit or expense. In that case, the base against which the 40% would be calculated would bring in a higher corpus value for the trust fund, and therefore the 5.5% per year would also be higher. Some of the items at issue there are the unclaimed prize money. The lottery has to maintain money in order to, I think a ticket is good for up to a year after its drawing, and so they have to maintain a reserve fund against the possibility of somebody finally digging in the laundry and finding their ticket. Then after that year is up, then the question is, well, was it a real expense, or is it really part of the profit? Well, currently, the unclaimed prize money is sent now to the general fund.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, I'm going to try and simplify it, Director Velen. And first of all, I don't want you to take – I think you guys do a terrific job. You got four employees. You're managing an unbelievably big fund. When we compare RLC-CMR – to other states, you are by far the cream of the crop. And my direction is not at you, it's at the legislature, because the crux of it is, as you're talking, the gray box is over twice as big as the green box. And the TV ads show a loon, and I'm saying they should show a school book and a road on them also, because the reality is we've only been getting a third of the money, and if we'd be getting all of the money instead of a third. And I'm talking, I realize the profits, you better give most of the money back to the people buying the scratch-offs or they're not going to buy them. But the reality and the misconception with the general public is they think the proceeds, the profits of the scratch-off, are going to help the environment.
My point is we'd have three times $23 million, and Representative Tingle said would be here presenting a $7 million budget that we'd be using to help clean up the water. So what I'm saying is I hope that we look as we move forward, the legislature, and Representative Hansen and I think are on the same page on this, that we tell people the reality. You're looking for more money for clean water. Folks think we're already getting this money, and the pot is in the neighborhood of an additional $67.81 million that went to the general fund to help the kids that deserve it and build roads or health and human services, whatever. But it's not going for the loon that we see on TV necessarily. And then my other point is, so you kind of camouflaged it a little bit, where we really only get a third and the general fund gets two-thirds, you got some gimmicks that we use about overhead and stuff so that we end up not getting 40%, we get 33%. Is that the bottom line? And again, I'm not directing that at you. It's gimmicks that we in the legislature are doing, and you're implementing what we tell you to do.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, you are correct. The arithmetic does come out. I think it was Senator Bob Lessard who caught this early on, that the real percentage received by the trust fund is lower than expected. Part of that started with the in-lieu of sales tax, because that comes right off the top of the dollar, so we work off a 94-cent or 93.5-cent dollar instead of a 100-cent dollar. So that was the first blow, and then the unclaimed prizes, and then advertising and administration. And Senator Dennis Fredrickson would agree wholeheartedly with you. He had a real heartache when that loon came out as the logo for the lottery, some, goodness, close to 20 years ago.
Did somebody else have a question? Representative Hansen, and then I think we need to move on with the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Valine, just to follow up on that, the determination of net proceeds, is that defined in statute or in the Constitution? Does that mean if it is in statute, we could change that in statute?
Madam Chair, I think it's in the Constitution.
The
5.5% is in the Constitution. The 40% is in statute.
No, they're both in the Constitution.
The definition of the net, I correct that. The definition of the net proceeds is in the statute. So the 40% is in the Constitution, as is the 5.5%, but I think Representative McNamara is correct. It's the definition in the statute that winds up fluctuating the real dollar amount that comes in.
Members, I think with questions like these, I am hearing a need for information on this. And so what we will do is make sure that in your packets next time are the Constitution, the statute, and perhaps some more pie charts that folks can look at. And then, after that is digested, if people are interested, we'll bring somebody in from one of our fiscal analysts in, I believe, to talk about that. Is that suitable?
Madam Chair, I do believe we have just what you're talking about. I believe this blue sheet specifically does show the changes that were made and that it is defined in the Constitution. And I think just to clarify, if I could really quickly, Madam Chair, Mr. Valine, Director Valine, I believe the citizens of Minnesota actually voted again to amend the Constitution in 1998 after the original bill. And so some of this language was from the 98 constitutional amendment.
Correct.
But it's on the back, I believe, of the blue sheet that we do have it.
Just a quick point, Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Moe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative McNamara, we've researched this a bit, too, as I know you have, and you are dead on right, that we can, in statute, rededicate the portion of this that is going to the general fund to the appropriate purpose, and I think we should do that.
Well, I think there's some common ground, at least in this committee. I don't know about in the legislature. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you. I apologize again, but Representative Moe, my bad hearing after 30 years as a landscaper, I thought you said can't. I'm assuming you said can. Thank you.
Yes. Representative Solberg, I am so glad you're here for this discussion. Members, are you agreeing with me on that? Representative
Madam Solberg. Madam Chair, as we are talking about, as one who has to defend the general fund sometimes, because I'm sure every one of you want to have some nice educational opportunities and money going to education and so forth. So every dollar you take out of that is less to nursing homes and education. I just want you to understand it, unless, of course, you are also willing to push a little button to enhance the revenues in some way, called revenue stream increase or whatever you want to have it called. Mostly we call it taxes. But my question is, on, and I don't know, I usually, when I ask a question, I know the answer beforehand. But this one I don't know. The additional $2.19 million was transferred to the state general fund from the unclaimed prizes in what year?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that started in 2003.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I just want to emphasize that. I thought I knew the answer, but I didn't know for sure. 2003. And why was it done? It was done to help balance the general fund. And who was in charge?
We will leave that on the table and proceed with Representative Tingelstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And now that Representative Solberg here is here, I wanted to make note that he was the co-chair of the LCMR Reorganization Task Force that met over several months along with Dave Zantner in putting together this new process with citizen involvement and switching to an annual basis and all the different things that are reflected in this bill. So thank you, Representative Solberg.
Thank you.
Members, I think it's best to work off this white sheet that shows each of the projects delineated. And I'm going to just kind of give some highlights. I've got additional information here, and certainly within the bill is more information about each of the projects. I don't know how we're situated for time, Madam Chair. I know that you do have an amendment, and I'm sure there's other questions as well. But working off this sheet with Subdivision 3 is the LCCMR and contract administration. And I wanted to make note here that those costs are for 2 years, and most of these other projects, as we noted, we're doing on a one-year basis. Some of the funding is available a little longer, depending on their growing season and other issues. But we had a thorough discussion in the LCCMR group about the importance of securing our staff for the next 2 years, and so we thought it was important to put the funding in for 2 years right in this initial package. So to follow up with that, then a year from now, those costs will not be in next year's package. So some of this is sort of things that lead into the next year. And I wanted to make note, too, with my notebook and folder here, all the time involvement and commitment of the 17 members to bring this list to you. There's some of the projects that came in that were continuing funding. All of them presented once or twice, most of them twice. Then we did an RFP for water, and there were many more projects submitted than what we funded. We went through a very thorough process of analyzing them, brought some of them in for hearings, so hundreds of hours by the members of the commission as well as the staff, to cull all this information down to what's before you now in House File 293. So Subdivision 4 deals with land projects, $14.8 million. Forest Legacy was a big discussion there and the importance, and we've heard testimony in past days about that in this committee and elsewhere. So many of these projects are ones that LCMR has looked at for several years. We think they're very important projects. They reach out into greater Minnesota and beyond. And, Minnesota Habitat Corridors Partnership, the Metro Conservation Corridors, many partners working on that and really leveraging lots of great funds through other funds available. The Prairie Stewardship Assistance, State Park and Land Acquisition, Metro Regional Park System acquisition piece, the non-metropolitan regional parks, the LACON federal reimbursements, and actually I'd like to turn this piece over to Director Valleen to just tell you how this piece comes together. It's a little bit different with the rest of the package.
Madam Chair, the on page 7, it's item starting at line 7.28. LACON stands for Land and Water Conservation Fund, and it's a federally created fund designed in 1963 to help recreation across the nation. It's the fund is populated by royalties from offshore oil drilling, and so over the years it's become a pretty good sized fund. Congress has not always delivered the amounts to the National Park Service and to state and local governments that were understood and agreed upon early on, but nevertheless continues a heritage of acquisition and facility development for recreation across the nation. Roughly 50% federal and 50% goes to the various states. In Minnesota, we've chosen, going way back to the 60s, to further divide our portion of the land and water money, 50% for state projects, which would be state parks, WMAs, a whole range of eligible recreation facilities, and the other 50% is for local governments. Those are done, that money is delivered to local governments for eligible acquisition and development activities through the local grant program in the Department of Natural Resources run by Wayne Sames out of the Office of Management and Budget Services. It's been a very successful, highly sought after amount of money. I think he gets about $12 million in applications every year. LACON money that's available here, excuse me, there's a mirror amount. This $500,000 is for state activities. The mirror amount, the 50% from our statute, goes out in grants to local units of government. Now, this particular $500,000 is not going to make its way all the way to the ground, because with the LACON program, every facility that's purchased with land and water money, there is created a perpetual obligation to maintain that facility in recreation purposes, typically by the local unit of government. And if they want to change that, they have to go through a conversion process. The National Park Service administers the land and water money. And if they want to change that, they have to go through a conversion process to make sure that there is still a net gain in recreational activity for the citizens. So there's an oversight role, and that has to be paid for. Literally, these projects, I think I was told one time that there's about a dozen of these conversions that come in every year. Each one has to be inspected, investigated, negotiated, and finalized in order to get the roller rink that they want to build in the park to create some mitigation land somewhere else, or to somehow create a net gain. So there's a fair amount of follow-up work to be done there. In addition, the state has to produce, I think it's every 5 years, something called a SCORP, Statewide Comprehensive Outdoor Recreation Plan. And that plan, the federal requirement to do that plan and for eligibility is fairly extensive. You have to do a bunch of research on recreation trends. Some of the material you've been seeing in recent years, in recent weeks, about declines in trends of hunting, fishing, bird watching, trail walking, and so forth. Some of that data is supported by collecting some of this money. So there's an administrative role in the oversight, and there's a planning role that the state has to do also. My recollection is about $274,000 of this will go for the oversight and the planning, and the residual for state facility projects as determined by the Commissioner of Natural Resources. And again, that could be a scientific and natural area acquisition, or a state park development, or a trail someplace. We simply don't know what those are at this point. The commissioner's purview will be used.
I do want us to go a little bit faster, if we could. Representative Clark.
Good question. I just wonder, Is there any built-in bias for the type of recreation that's supported? You mentioned bird watching and trails versus, say, you know, snowmobiles and those sort of things. Is there sort of bias built in there?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, I haven't seen any particular bias. I know there's a very strong requirement, and it's followed assiduously by the Department of Natural Resources, that handicapped accessibility is a very high priority, both in the local grants and in the spending of the state share of this for facilities, to make sure that those people the entryways, the gates, the bathrooms, and all that kind of thing are fully accessible. And that's another part of what the oversight is spent on, is making sure that the facilities are correct. In terms of the state facilities, they tend to be much broader in their purposes. It's a state park acquisition. State parks, some state trails, scientific and natural areas, a few wildlife management areas. Those are my recollection of the nature of things.
Representative Tinkelstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So continuing then with subdivision 4, those last two items, the biological control of European buckthorn and the neutralization of the reed canary grass. You know, I think these are two of the typical examples of some of the things that the LCCMR can do as sort of the research and development branch of the environmental areas here in state government. And then proceeding on to subdivision 5, the water resources, and that was the focus that the LCCMR chose for this year. We'll be looking at a different focus area potentially next year as we're starting to work on that process, which will begin in June here. We're looking at doing new RFPs next year, probably late summer, early fall, to bring you a package a year from now. So with subdivision 5, the local water management matching grants, you know, some of the good outreach into the state of Minnesota there, protection of rare and unique outcrop wetlands, land retirement effects on Minnesota River Basin, conservation grasslands and how they affect water quality, improved river quality monitoring, evaluating riparian timber harvesting guidelines. That's a phase 3 project. Looking at mapping for trout stream management. We looked at various kind of high-tech things, and actually one of the things we're going to be doing is looking into that more and how it relates to the various things that are out there now with computer applications and mapping and evaluating land and water resources. The County Geologic Atlas Program, acceleration of that, the impacts of climate change. And then these last few items in Subdivision 5, I think, are some of the most exciting ones that we're looking at. I know when we started the LCCMR process last August, I said personally my goal would be to get some projects in this package that people could look at and say, wow, those are great projects, and without LCCMR, without this funding, we think that they may not happen. And these last several here, especially the Cedar Creek Groundwater Project and the Paralysis Pilot Project are two of those projects that really stood out, I think, through the process. And maybe if we could just have a minute here for Mr. Valine to talk about the Paralysis Pilot Project. I think that one is particularly unique and could have some good long-term implications for our state.
Madam Chair and members, on line 13.5, the Paralysis Pilot Project, how many know what pyrolysis is?
One.
Essentially, you can either burn something by lighting it, or you can cook it under an oxygen-starved environment. Pyrolysis is the latter. You starve the oxygen, it burns very, very slowly. It's a different kind of burn altogether. And it turns out that that can produce synthetic gases. The notion here, we've had a project in place in South Central and West Central Minnesota for several years, attempting to get landowners to develop alternative crops that would be profitable for them, other than the corn-soybean rotation. And these range all the way from hazelbrush to bundle flower to just a whole range of different things. The notion is, see if there can't be some things that would provide permanent cover on the ground. The next question is, if they grow these crops, what are you going to do with them? You need a market of some sort. With all the excitement about biofuels as an alternative energy source, this project will actually develop, it has developed in the laboratory, a pyrolysis unit that could be mobile. The idea is to make one that's mobile, put it on the back of a truck and drive around and make gas on site so that a 16 variety polyculture of native prairie grasses could be harvested, gasified on site, and now instead of trying to haul 40 tons of prairie grass hay to town or somewhere else for processing, you actually have a very high value product in terms of the synthetic gas on site. That can be used on the farm to generate electricity. It could be hauled into town in a propane pig. A variety of different things that could be done. Farmers could even sell the electricity off. Obviously, there are some implications with grid interaction and so forth. Either sell the gas or generate electricity in turbines on their own farm. This is a very exciting prospect, and it answers one of the big questions about biofuels. How do you deal with the marketplace, and how do you get it to the marketplace? The classic problem with agriculture has been relatively low value and high volume product. Moving it to the marketplace has required a huge institutional infrastructure investment in the form of roads and railroads and granaries and mills and so forth. This might be a real answer to a variety of different questions out over the future.
So moving on then, Madam Chair, members.
Yes. Representative Mo, and then...
Just a quick technical question. When you said, Madam Chair, when you said farmers are growing hazel brush, and then you went into this pyrolysis, is that correct? Technology for creating synthetic gas. Are you saying that hazel brush could be used for that? Because in the northern Minnesota, we got a lot, and we would just as soon get rid of it because it really makes forest regrowth very difficult.
Madam Chair, Representative Moe, absolutely. It is one of those crops that, A, is perennial, so it covers the soil, holds the soil in place. You don't like it in some places because of the way it edges out other trees that are more desirable. But the potential, I mean, literally what these people are growing is not hazel brush, it's filberts. They're selling nuts. But the bush looks about the same as the one you're talking about. That bush can be harvested and processed. As a matter of fact, there are some people who would like to get rid of lots of brush in certain areas in order to have better sharp-tailed grouse habitat. There are actually projects in place that the DNR does going around shearing this brush to get rid of it. It could be collected, pyrolysized, I think is the right term there, and turned into a usable gas, synthetic gas.
We will be hearing more about these in a coming committee hearing from IRE. Representative Peterson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And on this, it's interesting emerging issues. It is. I'm becoming aware that the agency that would handle the air emissions permit from these syngas, biomass gasification ideas, BCA, isn't staffed up nor has enough historical knowledge as to how to deal with or grant the air quality permit. So, you know, you're going to run into that. So I would encourage the agencies to, you know, pick up pace, if you will. Second, has this been discussed in terms of backing up wind power, if you will, on-site wind power? And if it's below 40 kilowatts of stored power, then you might have to pay the net metering rate that the utility would have to pay, and then you're going to really find a lot of opposition to this idea.
Madam Chair, I think there's two questions there. One is, are the agencies prepared to deal with the air quality impacts of these alternative fuels? And there's a two-part answer. One is, no, of course not. The other is, I'm not too worried about it, because most of these biofuels produce zero or very, very, very little air pollution. Zero or very, very little. Wind, yeah. Hydrogen, prairie grasses when they're burned in pyrolysis. Matter of fact, when you have a grass fire, a planned burn, that is, if you notice the fire, the color of the smoke is almost pure white.
Right.
On a native prairie stand, almost pure white. That means that there's almost no pollution in that smoke, compared to a pile of leaves that starts out a little white and then gets really dark and heavy. So it's a legitimate concern. I don't think it's going to be overwhelming, though. I really don't. I hope not.
No. Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up. Yes, I've burned prairie grass. It's very white smoke. But I just know an example in my district that, you know, an air quality permit is being held up for a private developer who's already got this figured out. This is the way to go. But it seems like up the road at the university, the air quality permit has been granted. So I'm finding some inconsistencies in the agency behavior here. And I think you're right with the emissions part, but getting it on the record twice in 2 days here.
Well, Representative Peterson, I think you're going to have an ample chance to get that on the record another time, because we will have PCA here for their budget, and that's an excellent question to keep in mind for that. I would like us to finish the presentation and then go to questions, if we could.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just real quickly then, Subdivision 6 is the natural resources information, the county biological survey, soil surveys, field guide for evaluating vegetation and natural resource data collection and mapping. And then into Subdivision 7, this was one of the recommendations from the reorganization task force, to have an emerging issues account so that we can deal with issues that come up with a short amount of notice, where we could act quickly and make a difference, having some funding available quickly. And then the last few pages of the bill there get into some of the clarifying and other detailed information about the availability of the appropriations, leverage funds for real estate, data availability requirements, project requirements, payment conditions, capital equipment, purchase of recycled and recyclable materials, which of course is important for these projects, the energy conservation and sustainable guidelines, making sure they're followed within these projects, carry forward, which is a few projects that traditionally there's some minor changes in some of the projects that occur, and then the last page 19 on public meetings, some clarifying language related to now having citizens on the commission and some issues that came up through our meeting process. So with that, Madam Chair, that's the walkthrough on the bill, and happy to answer more questions, and I know you do have an amendment.
Yes, and we are going to pass on this bill today, so members, keeping the time in mind, I will invite folks from the audience if they want to testify for or against, so keep that all in mind as you ask questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick question on Subdivision 14 of page 17 on the energy conservation and sustainable buildings. How much funding do you anticipate would be available for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Magnus, that's not an appropriation. That's a condition that applies to any of these other appropriations. In fact, we aren't building any buildings this time, so it's not going to have any particular effect. But over time, there have been a variety of different types of buildings, either demonstration or real, that we want to make sure comply with the highest possible energy and green building, sustainable building designs.
Madam Chair, that's a good point, because yesterday in the Energy Committee, we had a presentation by one of the utility companies that is building a new headquarters in Maple Grove, and they anticipate that building, the headquarters building, will use one half of the electricity that a typical building today would use. So I would encourage you to keep working on things like this. That'll make a big difference in conservation.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius. Mr. Valline, under Forest Legacy, which is on page 3, it talks about, on line 3.24, it talks about an easement acquired must have a sustainable forestry practice management plan. Does that plan, the sustainable forest practice management plan, have provisions in it to assure access for hunting and those type of activities? Or how are we assured when we do these forest legacy easements that we have that memorialized in the easement?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, the forest management plan is usually only pointed to the to the land management, the timber management, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that is really the only commercial activity that can go on once the easement's been purchased. In terms of access, that varies by owner and negotiation. If you notice a little bit further down in 3.3 through 3.36, the commission is calling for the DNR to provide a set of standards that would be evident and hopefully then would answer this question a little bit better, because it does vary quite a bit. The targets of these this particular appropriation are both some of the large industrial lands in the north, as well as some smaller lands in the southeast called the Mississippi Blufflands areas. And the nature of public access is probably going to be different in different areas. Some of these smaller ones, some of these are quite a bit smaller than the large northern tracts.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, I think we need to have a little bit clearer understanding of that, because my recollection is that if you have a sustainable forest plan, that in and of itself under law would provide for public access. Now, I might be mistaken on that. Maybe that's a different, maybe under the tax code instead of this code. But I thought there was it was the requirement. I thought it was bonding, though, anyway, when we went there. I might be mistaken.
Let me see if I can help out here. Representative Solberg, in the bonding bill, there was direct language that said that there must, and the word was must, be access for Forest Legacy. It was actually as part of the rider language.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. But as you know, and you pointed out to me, even the language that's in the bonding bill can be convoluted. Once you put these contracts together, the way you word the contract, you can have access, but it might not be during hunting season. So this is something that we're going to have to change. And Madam Chair, I think maybe we should come up with some language to get it in this bill.
I'm going to present some language here that I think is going to actually help you out, Representative Hackbarth. So why don't, right at this point, because it's one of the issues I was trying to get at, why don't I put my amendment before you, members? I'm going to move Amendment A1. And there are two sentences, and there are two distinct provisions. One is parties to an easement must specify in the easement all the provisions of their agreement that are to be perpetual. And that states the obvious on one hand, but we've had a sense, and Representative Hackbarth, you and I have discussed it, that sometimes people think they're getting in easements things that they are not. And so the next piece of the not sentence, but it goes on to say electronic copies of these easements will be filed with the commission. I am a big believer in if the public knows what's going on, things will go on right. It's sunshine. And this is, so there will be copies of all the easements sent to the commission. Later on, members, you will be hearing from DNR that they don't have a good tracking system for easements, and they're going to be asking us to help them along with that. And I think that's something we're going to spend some time on, tracking and knowing about easements. And we will spend some time on that, Representative Hackbarth. But in the meantime, I think the commission did provide the language that combined with this, the language on page 333 to 336, DNR will come to the commission with a set of proposals, and that set of proposals will include public access, and if it doesn't, we'll make sure it does. So because people So you all have a chance now to work with DNR between now and June to get those provisions exactly like you want them. So that is what that language is all about. So, and I invite you to
I hope you will do it. I can't really invite you to do it, but I certainly hope you'll do that. Representative Moe.
Madam Chair, to the amendment. First, I want to thank you for working with those of us who are concerned about Forest Legacy, using your legal skills to help us to close this up a little bit. But there's, as Representative Hackbarth points out, there's far more, much further to go. And not only are, do we not have recreation access guaranteed, but these large investment houses that own this property are, in fact, then leasing out that recreation access to others, and then, but still getting lower tax status, the timberland tax status. So I think when we move forward with this, we need to make sure we have perpetual access, and if not, they have to pay for it otherwise. If they're leasing that out, they need to pay recreation land tax.
This bill will be going to taxes, and part of that is because of the, not part of it, is because of the easement question. So I see no further questions about the amendment. I have moved. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposition? The amendment is adopted. It's been, members, I do really strongly suggest you work with DNR between now and June on the easement language for access. I certainly will be doing that. I hope you all will be doing it too.
Madam Chair.
I think Representative Maximer is working on an oral amendment quickly that would satisfy our concerns.
In the meanwhile, are there members of the audience who would like to testify for or against?
Madam Chair, I'd like to just note, too, that another member of the LCCMR has joined us, John Herman, one of the citizen members. Thanks.
Okay. I see nobody in the audience who wants to testify for or against. We can see an oral amendment, but I would also tell members that you have an opportunity to work with DNR on language that will be adopted now. So, yes, Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. As I don't serve on taxes, I would like to make a small oral amendment on page 3, line 26. After the word plan, and I would ask Mr. Helen, if he would listen as I say it, as he's much better at this than myself, insert the words, including year-round public access for recreation. So it would say, with the intent being, and I guess I would ask Mr. Helen clearly, that for recreational purposes would include things such as bird watching, it could be trout fishing on the stream, fishing, hunting, berry picking, things like that. I thank Representative Hackbarth for bringing it forward, because I jumped at the thought right away. That was the whole idea for Forest Legacy, and I guess I'd like to get this added in. I understand it's going to taxes, not serving there, and been part of the bonding conference committee last year. I certainly thought that we were guaranteeing. I mean, that's why we're spending. Was $7 million in the bonding bill, and now we got $2 million here. I know the DNR may be working on it, but I guess that's our job to get it moving.
Okay. If you could have counsel repeat that for the committee.
Madam Chair, I don't have the language. He wrote it on his bill, so if Representative McNamara wouldn't mind repeating it.
Representative McNamara, I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I will repeat it. Mr. Helen, on line 3.26, after the word plan, before the period, including year-round public access for recreational purposes. And then, Madam Chair, I would ask if we could ask Mr. Helen if some of the things that I just mentioned it would be construed. I would want it to be accessible for bird watching, berry picking, hunting, fishing. That must all be construed in these big blue books behind us in recreational purposes.
Representative, I mean, counsel.
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, recreational purposes is a very broad term, and there is a definition for outdoor recreation in the statutes that includes all types of recreation, from bird watching to snowmobiling. Hunting and fishing is included.
Okay. Excuse me. I heard the word outdoor in there. Council, I thought I heard you say the word outdoor recreation. You meant outdoor recreation. Could you take that as a friendly amendment? Would you incorporate that? Include year-round outdoor recreation?
Well, my only thought would be, Madam, yeah, that's fine. Yep, yep.
Because I thought I heard that's what you had said. There's a definition of. Is that okay?
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
Madam Chair. And maybe this is to the author of the amendment. Does that also include ATVs, dirt bikes, pickups? I mean, what are we doing here? This seems kind of major.
Yeah.
I just want to know if we are opening up the whole forest. You know, this seems kind of major, and I don't know. Did the chair know about this amendment ahead of time?
I did not. But this is the kind of. I mean, I want us to write our bills so they are right when they come out of this committee, and there is a lot of strong feeling about this particular issue. So if we can get it in good shape, I would like to see us be able to do it. But there is an issue here that Representative Clark has brought up, and is there a way to deal with that issue, Representative McNamara?
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I guess my recommendation is then just to continue the bill and work it out. That, you know, this napkin, major policy on a napkin behavior, I just don't support. And I would rather you do not adopt this amendment right now.
Right. I can see that there is some split in the committee, and we do have ample time right now, and we want to come to a consensus on this particular language, because I know it's extraordinarily important to people. And so what we will do is lay the bill over just for the purposes of of working out some language that we hope then will be consensus language. And with that, I'm going to lay the bill up on the
table. Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just make a comment to that amendment we were just discussing. Somebody just pointed out to me that the grammatical piece, the way that Representative McNamara presented it, it modifies management plan and not easements. So if the word and includes year-round instead of including, it would clarify it a little bit more. But I understand we're going to discuss this further. Appreciate the committee's time today. Thank you.
Thank you, all members. And there's no further business before the committee, and the committee is adjourned.